So fish are aquatic vertebrates that have most of the same organs and or tissues, equivalent tissues, as humans. One of the big differences is the endocrine system. While they have most of the tissues, thyroid, the equivalent of adrenal glands, they're not individual organs that we can easily cut out. They're within other tissue. However, fish do live and reproduce in habitats that humans also recreate in, that many people get their drinking water from, and also some people obviously eat. And so when you see, when people that are catching fish see lesions such as this, or even these eroded lesions, obviously they get upset. This is an interesting, I'm not going to talk much about it, but it's a case from a lake in Vermont where 25% of the adult brown bullheads have these, they're actually melanomas, and they're very invasive, they actually metastasize. So from a pathology point of view, it's really cool. From a human potentially, or fish health, is not so cool. Some of the complexities that we have in determining contaminant exposures in the aquatic environment are, as we've heard multiple times, there are literally thousands of chemicals that are getting into our water systems. And often, we're not looking at the time when the most sensitive developmental periods occur. And with fish, just as we've heard from others, exposures to those very young, as they're differentiating, may not show up until they become adults, mature adults. The other thing that I want to point out is that we feel, and I'm very interested in the effects of some of these chemicals on disease resistance. And so looking at how they affect the response to infectious disease, I think, is really important. So some of the issues that we have to deal with is when you go out and you take a water sample or a sediment sample, it's a snapshot in time. And it may also be just a snapshot of a particular group of chemicals you're looking at. The other thing as far as fish health is that most of the monitoring that's done on the fish tissue is done either on the fillets or whole body. And one of the things that we found, which is sort of good news for people that are eating fish, is that many of these newer chemicals are not necessarily accumulating in the muscle, which is good for the people that are eating it. But what we're finding is that, for instance, many of them we see the highest concentrations either in the eggs or in the brain tissue. And so not so good for the fish that have to deal with it. The other thing, as we've heard over and over again, is that we see biological effects at levels where no one chemical is above what they call the threshold benchmarks. And so we're dealing with complex mixtures. And our, for the past probably 20 years, our emphasis has been using fish as integrators to look at this aquatic system because they're constantly exposed to various stressors, not only things like chemicals, but climatic effects, pathogens. They integrate over time. And hopefully we can, by looking at what we call adverse effects monitoring, identify some of these. So we use a suite of biological indicators. We go out in the field, we do a necropsy. So we're looking at indicators from the organism level, so things like condition factor, gonadosomatic index, down to the molecular level. And we have also just recently, in the last 2 years, started including immune function. So in the field, we can actually take out anterior kidney, which is a sort of the functional equivalent of bone marrow. We homogenize it in the field, we keep them cold, we take them back to the lab, and you can actually measure function of lymphocytes, macrophages, other parts of the immune system. We also do histopathology, that's actually my field. So we take pieces of all the tissue to look at microscopically. The molecular, there's been a lot of work with gene expression in fish, but a lot of it has been done with what we call the model organisms. So things like fathead minnows, madaka, zebrafish, which are small fish that can be kept in the lab. They live a couple years, they reproduce quickly. And so most of the information comes from that. What we've been trying to develop is molecular ways to look at what we're seeing in wild fish or non-model species. And the reason for that is that we have learned not all fish are created equal. Just as Tyrone talked about, not all frogs are created equal. So we see a lot of differences in species sensitivity. So it's really important, depending on the question you're asking and the answer you want to get, what species you pick to look at. And multiple contaminants can have the same effect in different environments. So a lot of people would like to know what is the answer for a particular, say, intersex in fish. But in one environment, it might be estrogen. In another environment, it might be atrazine. So there isn't going to be necessarily one cause. So just some examples, again, not the prettiest pictures. I'm going to give some examples of things that we've been looking at, just a couple real quickly, fish health issues that I think could potentially have some human health implications. We do a lot of work up in the Great Lakes. Tumors in fish have been used as indicators at what are called areas of concern in the Great Lakes. And historically, these tumors have been related to PAHs, which there is good evidence that PAHs do, at least for the liver tumors, are associated. But what we're still finding is that despite millions and millions of dollars of restoration, removing contaminant sediments, all sorts of remediation, is we're still seeing livers that look like that. This is a big ugly tumor on a white sucker, and a lot of these lip lesions. This is actually a squamous cell carcinoma. This is a papilloma. Those were just collected last year in the Sheboygan River, and over 8% of the fish we collected, and we did a sample size of 200, had liver tumors. Over 15% had the skin tumors. So still an issue, and I think the point I'm trying to make is maybe we need to be thinking beyond PAHs. When we do these studies, we're actually paid simply to tell them what the prevalence of the tumor is. I'm told we don't really want to look at what the cause is. We collect tissues anyway we want to do molecular work on these to try to see, maybe understand better what the causes are. Another thing I'll briefly talk about is yellow perch, reproductive declines in some areas in the Great Lakes, as well as some urban areas in the Chesapeake. This was some work I did quite a few years ago, where they asked us again to look histologically at what might be going on. On the left, you can see these sort of bumpy testes from Lake Michigan compared to the normal testes from our control lake. And what we found when we looked at those was testicular cancer, testicular neoplasia. And again, very high percent of fish in these areas, anywhere from, depending on the time of year, 27 to 31% of the males had testicular cancer. What's interesting, as I got into the literature trying to figure out what might be causing that, was there is in humans a somewhat similar syndrome, this testicular dysgenesis syndrome. And probably some of the human people will talk more about that. But the point is that there is some suggestion that some of these findings in humans are due to exposure at early life stages. That show up, I think, with the testicular cancer in humans, it's primarily in young adult males. So, some of the similarities we see with the perch, They do have smaller testes. We do what's called a gonadosomatic index, where we look at the weight of the testes, a ratio of the weight of the testes to the weight of the fish, and that gives us an indication. Presence of gonadal abnormalities, and then this high level of the testicular tumors, which are seminomas similar to what's seen in the humans. The other thing I'm going to spend a little more time on is something I have been working on for a long time, and something again that sort of indicates when you do this adverse monitoring, looking for adverse effects, that sometimes you find things you're not looking for. So back in 2002, 2003, we had major fish kills in the South Branch of the Potomac, which is in West Virginia, and the DNR asked us to try to figure out why the fish were dying. A couple years later, major fish kills in the Shenandoah. We started work in Virginia. There was another fish kill in the Monocacy River in Maryland. And about 2005, in the Susquehanna, they started noting similar kinds of lesions, but they, instead of being in the adults, as we see in the Potomac, they were in the young of the year. And they actually felt they were seeing population declines. So when we looked at the adult fish over a number of years in the Potomac, basically what we came up with was multiple bacterial pathogens, but no consistent finding. Sometimes the fish have a virus called largemouth bass virus. They have heavy parasite loads. And by looking at the gonads, we found intersects, which at that point we weren't looking for, and vitellogenin in male fish. Interestingly enough, when you look at the young of the year in the Susquehanna, we see a very similar thing. Multiple bacterial pathogens, largemouth bass virus, and lots of parasites. Now remember, these fish are only 2 to 3 months old, and they're already, they are hammered with parasites. This is a myxozoan cyst, and as they increase in size, you can actually see them. Here we have bacterial and myxozoan lesions. The intersects that we see in smallmouth bass, we don't tend to see hermaphrodites, as has been shown in the amphibians. But what we see are these immature eggs in the testes of the fish. And in this case, you can still see that fish is producing mature sperm. So these are the eggs. This is actually mature sperm. So these fish do reproduce, but we have found that they produce slightly less sperm and it's less motile. So over time, we could have population effects. But smallmouth bass are fish that live for a long time. We get fish that are 10, I think our oldest one has been 15 years in the Susquehanna. So it might take a long time for a population effect to show up. Just briefly, I think both Tyrone and I have mentioned vitellogenin. Vitellogenin is a precursor to egg yolk. So normally it's produced in the liver of females, goes through the bloodstream and is incorporated into eggs. And as Peter talked about last night, there are things that turn on genes that normally aren't turned on. So males have the gene for vitellogenin, but it's not normally turned on. Exposure to estrogen turns it on. And so you can actually measure vitellogenin in the bloodstream of males. One of the nice things about that for fish is that it can be a non-lethal. Obviously, many of these things that I've talked about, it's a lethal. We have to kill the fish to look at them. With the vitellogenin, you can actually take a blood sample, not kill the fish, if it's a, for instance, if it's an endangered species, and look for vitellogenin. But the other nice thing about doing all three of these is that it gives you a different time. It helps you to understand exposure periods. So most of the lab exposures have suggested that intersex is induced early in life, and then you see it later. With vitellogenin, it's induced, and if you take that stimulus away, depending on the fish species, it will last anywhere from days to months in the plasma. the transcripts, actually looking at the transcripts in the liver, that just takes days, hours, sometimes hours to days to turn on. So you can actually start to understand a little bit more about exposure. The other thing I want to say is that the whole concept of endocrine disruption affecting the immune system is something I think that we need to think more and more about. We know, for instance, and this is not just with fish, that estrogens do affect the immune system. This was some work we did where we showed that estrogen exposure affects the ability of the macrophages to engulf bacteria and to kill them. So this is sort of our emphasis in the next couple years, till I retire maybe, or beyond. Anyway, as a sort of going on toward, okay, what did we find as far as causes for some of these? Like many people, we started looking at wastewater treatment effluent because back in the early 2000s, that's what had been associated with intersex in fish. What we found, however, in the Potomac and in the Susquehanna is that we were not seeing a correlation with upstream and downstream. Oftentimes, upstream had higher intersex prevalence and severity than downstream. However, what we did find was an association in that area with agricultural land use. So in the Pennsylvania study we did, where we looked at the three major river systems, that was done in the summer. It was done during low flow, so it was post-spawning. And we found correlations with estrone, the major estrogen that we do measure in the environment. And as Tyrone said, these are correlations. I'm not saying it's cause and effect, but it certainly gives us a weight of evidence. In the Potomac study, we did that pre-spawn. We actually collected fish right off their spawning nests. And in that case, the only things in the water, and we looked at over 100 different chemicals, the things in the water that correlated with intersex were atrazine and metolachlor, two herbicides. In the sediment, biogenic hormones and plant sterols also correlated. So here's just some of the data from the Pennsylvania rivers. We had one site in the Delaware drainage, the Schuylkill River, which many of you probably know is downstream of Philadelphia. But focus on the ones in the middle because those are the Susquehanna. You can see as high as 100% of the males we collected had intersex. The other thing is, if you look at the top, the Ohio drainage, you'll see that there's one oocyte there in that section versus many in the section below from the Susquehanna. So the severity was also higher. This was kind of, at the time we did this, it was not what I was expecting because some of these sites were actually here in downtown Pittsburgh. And I expected we would see worse. We didn't. I think the take home is that, again, not all fish respond in the same way. And so bass seem to be very sensitive to chemicals that are in ag. Some of the factors to consider are the temporal nature of when those chemicals are there and when the fish are spawning. So bass produce, the male makes nests like you see on the right-hand side. It's the male that actually makes the nest. The female lays the eggs there and then goes away. And the male guards that nest and also guards the young when they first hatch. So one of the things I'm excited about is that through our environmental health program and also our Chesapeake Bay place-based studies, we've been able to get what I call long-term. For a lot of people, it's not long-term, but at least we're up to 4 years now, monitoring at these agricultural sites. We started with six, we're down to four. We collect monthly and during the spring, twice a month, water samples, plus we try to get storm events. We're doing sediment twice a year. We do the adult fish. We do the young of the year. We're collecting tissue samples for contaminant analysis. And what that's allowing us to do is actually look at what the fish are being exposed to at sensitive times of their life. So I have just one example to show the difference, not only seasonally, but also year to year. So if you look at the blue line, that's our atrazine concentrations over time in 2015. And you see we had two peaks, one of them there in the June to July, which is exactly when the young fish will be there and are going through sexual differentiation. If you look at 2016, I couldn't actually put the peak on because unlike the highest peak in 2015, which was 700 nanograms per liter, in 2016, it was more like 37,800. So huge differences year to year, as well as throughout the season. So what this is allowing us to do is not only look at those time periods, but also I'm really pushing to keep the funding to look some longer term, because now we can begin to look at the adults that we collect that were spawned in 2015 versus the adults that were spawned in 2016 and see, look at their reproductive as well as their immune system health. So I think that's it. So our approach is using this effect-based monitoring of wild fish, the chemical analysis, as I didn't talk about the in vitro bioassays, and then working with other people to put this all together in a population modeling risk assessment. And I will just briefly say there is a little bit of good news. I don't want to be totally negative. That using the population modeling for smallmouth bass populations in the Susquehanna, most of what we call the sub-basins, there was a decline in population in the 90s and early 2000s. And in some of the sub-basins, that's actually starting to come up. And so we really want to be looking at those and see what kind of management is going on that is allowing that to come up, the populations to rebound versus where they're not rebounding. And then I'll just say that there's a lot of people have been involved in this. We work really closely with all the state agencies, and we've had quite a few graduate students from both West Virginia University and Penn State involved. Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you very much for that wonderful talk, Vicky. The Potomac is hammered from all over the place, and the agricultural part of it, I think, is very big. It's extremely serious if you have a CAFO, a concentrated animal feeding operation, because of all the females going to the bathroom, and the initial estrogen that's released, estradiol, becomes estrone, which is the persistent one. But when you're looking at, for example, the Thames, the average water molecule going down the Thames goes through a water treatment plant nine times before it gets to the sea. And in many of the rivers, the actual river is the effluent plant outlet in many places. So it just so much depends on the nature of the river and the receiving body, etc., which bits and pieces of the Would you agree with
that? Absolutely. And that's one of the things when we first started looking, thinking wastewater treatment was going to be our big thing. The difference is that in the Potomac, at least at the sites we've been looking at, maybe 10 to 13% is wastewater effluent. I mean, it depends on years and flow and all that. But when that's very different than when you look at some smaller tributaries where sometimes of the year 95% might be effluent. So yes, definitely.
Yeah, Vicky, I just wanted to pick up on one comment and encourage your final research to clarify and make a plausible pathway between neuroendocrine disruption and immune function, specifically inflammation. So 80% of diabetes, cardiovascular disease, breast cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer is really inflammation. And there's a big debate in human medicine right now. Don't call these things cancers. Call them early inflammatory lesions, because men and women react very differently about management when you call them that. So if there is a clear pathway in animal models to Tyrone's that basically goes not only neuroendocrine disruption, where we see tumors because there's poor autoregulation to create those tumors, what is the inflammatory pathway that can be actually codified and disrupted periodically? So food for thought, but this is powerful stuff. But the pathway, to me, as a physician who worked with other physicians, is not clear. And your funding streams are always challenging. We understand that. But I think that's a huge piece of what we're dealing with collectively as a society. So just
I would definitely agree. And we see a lot of inflammation in the fish that we question. For instance, in the intersex fish, we see a lot of eosinophils around the nerves in the testes. What does that mean? But yes, you're right. I would definitely like to look more at that. And that's one of the places we hope our gene expression work might help.
Any other questions? We have a couple minutes, actually.
Great talk. Thank you. I'm going to say something provocative. It's sort of my job. If I were Syngenta and I just listened to all this, my advice to everyone here would be just wait. We're in a massive spasm of natural selection or chemical selection. It's leading to changes in the distribution of gene frequencies in these populations over time, leading to what in the future will be much less sensitive populations. So why don't we just wait?
Well, it's kind of interesting that you say that, because so in the Great Lakes studies, we were looking at two different sort of groups. We looked at the bass and we looked at the white sucker, the bullheads, which are bottom feeders, and then the bass are a top predator. And we hardly ever see tumors in bass, but we see tumors in the lower fish. What we do see in bass, though, is a lot of genetic, like micronuclei and things that genotoxic. And so, you know, one of my questions was, why is that? And I think part of it is that the bullhead and the white sucker have been exposed for so many years to some of those chemicals that they are resistant to the acute effects, but obviously they're getting tumors. So, you know, it's a trade. The bass may be dying before they get a tumor in those environments.
So my training is in evolutionary biology, and I know when you go through selective periods like this, you may gain resistance, but you lose something else. And I'm curious about what that something else might be. And I think the implications for people, you know, we're talking about reductions in fertility and increases in mortality. I think we are living through a period of human evolution at the molecular level that is most likely unprecedented in the history of our species. And I'd love to hear people think about that.
I think I saw one more question. We can take one more.
This is just a basic question. When you were collecting data from the Susquehanna, did you take into account proximity to Three Mile Island?
We do have a site close to there. We weren't specifically focusing on that. So I'd have to go back and see how that, you know, how our findings related. We do right around Harrisburg see a fairly high incidence of testicular oocytes or intersects.
One more question.
Yeah, the consequences, if any, for piscivorous animals, you know, within these areas where you see the high levels of intersects in the fish. What about the herons, the ospreys, the bald eagles, the mink, and so forth?
Up in the Great Lakes, I know there are reproductive effects in mink. I don't, from the people, I don't do birds, but our Patuxent lab has looked at some endocrine disrupting, potentially endocrine disrupting effects in birds, and I don't think they see a lot like similar to what we're seeing. And part of that, I think, is that many of these chemicals that would induce intersects, like, say, estrone, atrazine, are not necessarily biomagnified. Now, I will also say that one of the things that has been shown is DDE will induce intersects. And obviously, that is biomagnified, and we still find it in fish. The other thing I'll point out, for if you don't know, is that just recently, metformin, which is one of the most prescribed medications, and it's also one that is very commonly found in our water systems, has been shown to induce intersects. Not something you would think of, and I'm not sure the mechanism is totally known, but it has been reproduced in the lab. It was found at one of our sites, Milwaukee, somebody else, another investigator, Rebecca Clapper, found it in Milwaukee, but that's also where we see testicular oocytes and intersects in smallmouth bass.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Vicki.